The giraffe's real form.
Right. This letter says, Commanding Officer, you have with me agreement make that you for quartering my should pay. Please you give me one written evidence or mandate whereupon I reckon can. It is yet not the intention of you here for nothing in my house and garden with a troop soldiers to lodge with esteem M. Lamert. And then there's a P.S. Commanding Officer, there are moreover considerable damage from man growths and hotbeds arise. H. Lammers. Now he presented that to the commanding officer, who was a rather irascible man, who tried to read it and said to the RSM, take him out and shoot him, which of course was not his real intention, it was just a joke. But that was on the Dutch-German border, and one felt that there had been so much cooperation between Dutch and Germans in that particular area that there was not a lot of difference between Dutch and Germans, and they didn't really receive us very well at all. Well, that was particularly amusing.
He obviously wanted a bit of compensation anyway.
Yes.
But did you get a warm welcome from any Dutch?
Yes. One interesting thing, we had an interpreter with us who was the nephew of a former member of the regiment, and he suddenly turned up when we were in Holland and introduced himself. And he had been actually to Wallington, to the depot, and when he was a tiny boy, and his uncle had served in the regiment. And he suddenly introduced himself, and so we put him into uniform and used him as an interpreter for the rest of the war. Splendid chap, actually, a young boy about... I should think he'd be about 19 at the time. And we regarded him very much as a sort of mascot. He was a lovely one. And a very good interpreter.
What was the fighting in the Reichswald like?
Oh, that was very, very difficult. Fighting in forests is always horrible, and the Germans were fighting actually on their own territory, which made it very difficult. But you will remember, of course, that the Reichswald was bypassing the Siegfried Line. It was bypassing the Siegfried Line. And we were closing up to the Rhine. German units were being destroyed and reorganized. And there were many desperate defenses. The East Yorks have had a particularly difficult battle on a bridge where the Germans had been ordered to retake this bridge, and it was called the East York Bridge eventually, and they held on to it, and they killed, when they countered afterwards, they counterattacked. On the next day, there were at least 100 corpses which they'd killed on the in the counterattack. We we found it a very, very unpleasant battle indeed. Very unpleasant battle. Close quarter stuff, you know. Very much like the Bocard in Normandy in some ways, but forests are horrible to fight in.
For what reason?
Well, they're so easy to defend, after all. You see, a defensive position is much easier in the forest than in open country, where your views are so limited. Dug-in tanks, defensive positions, lines of fire and so on are so short that you suffer heavy casualties in forest positions.
Now, with the springtime and the crossing of the Rhine, did your battalion take part in that?
Yes, we didn't take part in the assault across the Rhine. We crossed the Rhine about, I think it was 1 or 2 days after this, the Rhine crossing. And the war then was virtually finishing. One felt immediately that it couldn't possibly last long. Once you were across the Rhine, you felt it couldn't last very long. And we went up from village to village. Most of our journey was in Holland, in Germany, in Holland again, in Germany. We travelled more or less at the border. And it was largely a question of movement. Occasionally you would get caught out in the open by possibly a single mortar, where just a small, a few troops had just were continuing to fight until they had all of their ammunition. And you're often caught out by a scarce amount of water. And I had my command there for my half track. The main thing about it was lack of sleep in those particular weeks up to the end of the war. Total lack of sleep, where you got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and then set off at 4 and then you didn't finish until whole group at midnight, and chaps began to fall asleep at the wheels of the vehicles. And I think Lord Haw-Haw was heard to broadcast that the British Army is staggering across the North German plain in total disorder, which was not quite right, but it made a point. And I remember once I was asleep as vehicles were moving, and the signals officer was a young man who just joined us, was in charge of battalion headquarters, and I told him where to stop. But brigade headquarters had also come up behind him and told him to clear off, you see, get ahead. And I would have stood up to him and told him what to do. But so he went forward, and we were right out on an open plain, and I woke up and got up and said, you know, what's he doing here? You know, it's a dreadful position. And then a mortar bomb fell about 30 yards ahead of us. And then immediately afterwards, it was about 30 yards behind. And so I was under the vehicle in no time at all, and being the only person who realized that they were targeting us, you know, bracketing us, and the third bomb fell right on the vehicle. Still got got a folder with the mortar shrapnel holes in it.
But you were unwounded. You were unwounded.
Oh, yes, I was under the rifle. The last operation we did, really the last operation we did was a place called Enschede. And we had, at that time, we had a second command called John Warner, who was quoted very much by, in Overlord and the Normandy campaign, by Max Hastings, quoted there. He'd come to us from 3rd Rec here, second in command, and at that particular operation he had to be in command, and we made a classic operation. It was an absolute classic operation according to the book, everything went right, because of course the enemy were more or less defeated at that particular time. And then we went, we stayed outside Bremen for a few days whilst the RAF bombed Bremen, and the Americans, I believe, bombed Bremen. And then we moved into Bremen, and the war finished.
What did you see in Bremen?
The gasworks, virtually, miles. At that time.
You mean it was anything left standing?
No. It's such a big city that we, our position, we were a lot in this particular western area of the city. And that's all we saw. You see, the other battalions, the other brigades, took the centre and the eastern side of it. So,
were there any citizens about?
Oh yes, one of them knocked me down with a bicycle actually, and he got up and immediately thought he was going to be shot, and was very glad to be able to get on his bicycle and go away.
Was he elderly?
I don't know. He don't remember. He was a middle-aged man, and he was riding a bicycle, and was horrified when he ran into me.
What was the general attitude of German civilians as you moved through?
One of the things that they did say was, why do you stop here? They were obsessed with the idea that communism was the great enemy. Everyone, all the Germans you spoke to, although we didn't speak to many, all said, why are you stopping now? Why do you not go into Moscow? They were obsessed with the idea that America and Britain should continue to Moscow.
But do you think it was fear of communism, or because they wanted to play off the two sets of allies?
Fear of communism, sure. Yes, the Russians were the great enemy.
Did you come into contact with the Red Army?
No. At one time, we had three of their officers in the mess. We didn't think much of their table manners. They smoked not only between courses, but through courses. And they were pretty rough types.
How did you come to have those people attached to you?
We didn't. We just entertained them on a particular day when they were coming to see what this was at the end of the war.
Was the non-fraternization order obeyed regarding the Germans?
Generally, yes, but we had the odd case. We had a court martial, a chap who was court martialed,
What had he been doing?
A widow. Yes. This German widow obviously falls for the guy.
Did you feel it was right to punish him for that?
I don't know that we punished him, actually. I don't remember what happened to him. I think he was... dealt with by the coma on the sentence.
What did you feel about the non-fraternization order, personally?
I thought it was right at the time. It would you can't suddenly go from warfare to peace. I employed a German typist, actually, and while I was coming on the corridor of this particular barracks, said, what's that, you know, she's wearing perfume and so on, and he thought it was a bit odd. But she was very useful. But no fraternization, just interest.
So you were allowed to employ them, but not to be friendly?
That's right.
How did you come to leave Germany and the army?
We were brought back into Belgium because at that time we were briefed down to battalion level for the assault on the mainland of Japan. The assault on the mainland of Japan was going to be almost exactly the same as the assault on D-Day. One British division, one Canadian division, one Australian New Zealand division, and two American divisions. Almost identical to the D-Day operation. And we were taken down to Holland, told that they were going to be re-equipped totally with American armament, and this was to be our particular task. But then, of course, came the atomic bomb and the cable. So the battalion then went to the Middle East. And I was by this time 34, and so I decided that I would take Class B release.
What's that?
Class B release was those people who could claim to in occupations and she required more than the army. So I took the Class B release, which meant that my release number was very much reduced.
We hear quite a lot nowadays about people needing counselling after they've been in combat. What do you think about that in view of your own experience?
I don't think it helps at all. Quite frankly, unless somebody's counselling you who's been through it themselves. And then the story I told you about, that battle exists in case there's a question of share of counselling, in a way. No, I don't think counselling is going to help anything.
Did you have nightmares or?
No.
Mental upsets after the war?
No.
Or found it difficult to adjust to family life?
No. I had no illness during the campaign. I ate well, I slept well. window when I got home. I readjusted very, very quickly. Very quickly. There was no problem at all about readjusting. As far as I was concerned. And of course, when I came to Blackwood Hill and took over this job, there was so much to do and so much. So many things to do. We worked so hard, we had to work so hard at first that we had no time. And as I say, people didn't even talk about the whole thing.
What are your feelings today in 1994 about having taken part in the Second World War and in particular in the D-Day landings?
I'm glad I didn't miss it. I'm glad I didn't miss it. Because I would have felt that I hadn't done my share. And I'm quite sure it altered a lot for me, being in a position of some authority. I became a magistrate soon afterwards. I feel, you see, in 1939, we'd heard about the Holocaust to a certain extent. We'd heard about Belsen, we'd heard about Dachau and places like that. And we knew that Germany, through excessive nationalism, had declined into depravity. There were so many things. The whole nation. It's no one saying it was just the SS or it was just Hitler and his brown shirts and so on, the Nazis. But all sorts of incidents occurred which made you realise that the whole nation was behind the Nazis. We had, during one battle, for example, we had two of our lads, a cottage had been set on fire by shelling. That were it our shelling or their shelling. And there was a baby, a young child, up at the window on the upstairs, and they tried to get in and up the stairs, which were burning. And they couldn't manage it. And the window was too small for the child to jump out. And the woman, the mother, was out down below wringing her hands and crying. And eventually, one of them was his uniform on fire. They gave it up. And the cottage went up in smoke, obviously, by that time the child was suffocated. And this woman said, as you probably know, the Führer had ordered all German women to produce as many children as possible for the Greater Reich. And she said, she suddenly shrugged her shoulders, dried her tears, and said, it was only one for the Führer, and walked away. No, you can't imagine someone in this country doing that. You can't imagine anybody saying, oh, it was just one for the Führer. And the same thing happened, I don't know if you know, that after the war, when the Control Commission took over, they followed up behind the troops and began to reorganize the German states and the various branches. And in the educational branch, they had Robert Burley, later Sir Robert Burley, headmaster of Eton, and he told all the assembled educationists there, he spoke to them and said, it's no good telling me that you didn't know, because you must have known what was going on. And I feel you know, we felt all this in, at D-Day. We felt that this was evil, that everything was evil. You know, there was no question of not defeating Germany. There was never any question. I mean, we probably wouldn't have defeated them without the Americans, there's no doubt about it. And they put up a tremendous defense. In fact, you know, let's face it, they were the greatest military nation in the world. No doubt whatsoever.